UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Okay, if we could colonize the front pews, that would be easier on my voice. I don't expect to have any by Sunday afternoon, but I'm trying to use it carefully. This is all of life under the Lordship of Christ, which is sort of a strange title, because what Christian would think of just two-thirds of the of life under the Lordship of Christ, or seven-eighths, or three-eighths, or something like that? It's kind of an obvious thing, one would think, that all of life is to be under the Lordship of Christ, if Christ is actually the Lord. But the thing I'm concerned with, which has been something LaBrie has been beating on like an old tin for years and years, is just the destructiveness of this kind of pattern that Jim Ingram was talking about last night, of a way of dividing reality into the sacred and the secular, the spiritual and the non-spiritual, in terms of some activities being spiritual and sort of important to God, and some other activities being intrinsically just unimportant to God, perhaps necessary for the world to work, but unimportant to Him. As I said, we'll address the question, which is more spiritual, to pray or to wash dishes? And it's interesting, this is a question that was asked to me by a frustrated student, thinking, okay, at last I've got to nail this guy down, and he can tell me, which is it? And I realized for a minute, if I go either way, I'm dead. I've lost the Christian faith. If I just say prayer is intrinsically more spiritual to do than washing dishes, I've lost it on one angle. I've gotten into Platonism. If I say washing dishes is intrinsically more spiritual to do than praying, I've become a Marxist. So I had to hedge there again, which is just the very thing that he didn't want me to do. But, you know, you just can't draw a line down certain kinds of activities like that and saying these matter to God, those don't matter to God. What about, sometimes it's more spiritual to wash dishes, like, for example, when it's your turn to wash dishes. And you could more easily say, oh, sorry, I've got to pray. And you go off to pray and leave a mountain in the sink for somebody else to come and deal with. Well, you know, that's not necessarily what God would have you do. And I think it just points to the mistake of drawing a line like that between certain kinds of activities and other kinds of activities and saying these are those that God is concerned with and those are not. Better, rather, to see, and this is a direct quote of Francis Schaeffer, all of life is spiritual except what is actually sin. All of life is spiritual except what is actually sin. I'll first of all start in on this whole pattern of what I've called divine spirituality, or a Platonic kind of a spirituality, or Jim was talking about Gnostic spirituality. It's all the same thing. And I'll talk about the challenge it offers and, in a sense, the attractiveness of it. Then talk about some biblical doubts about it. And then thirdly, that God calls us to a creative tension in our world. But first I'm going to put on this shirt. I didn't realize I'd have to wear warm clothes down here. And we thought, from everything we've heard, it would be the other way. But to start with the challenge of divided life spirituality then. I think it's powerful because there's so much truth in it. it moves us, it captivates us, because much of it is absolutely true. It starts out with the idea that this is the way you live your life with clear priorities, to make clear priorities, because there's a segment or sector of life which is for sure closer to the heart of God than other parts of life, which are maybe necessary, but less important to God himself, less things he cares about. High priority are my individual relationship to God, my sins forgiven, my life of prayer, of obedience, of Bible reading, of worship. These are what are important to God, and also evangelism, very central to what matters to God, that other people also might have eternal life. Nothing else matters at this level of importance, they would say, because these things have very clearly to do with eternity, where much of the rest of what we do has to do just with this world, this history, temporality, what is transient and going to change, what will not last forever, where this world is going to be rolled up and discarded or purged by God. We're talking about things that will last forever. We can safely ignore much of what goes on in the world, which doesn't deal directly with these things. Here I'm not giving my own view, I'm giving the other view that I'm going to lean against. I would have Christians say that many areas are necessary, fields are necessary for us, but are not really important to the heart of God. We can safely ignore them in terms of being areas where we really care about, where really that really move us and drive us to work, to live with a passion. They would be government, the whole political world, the sciences, law, the arts, the academic world in general, economics, manufacturing, are all necessary for society to work, but they're not as important as they seem to be because they're not dealing with what is eternal. They're not dealing with what is eternal. They are secular. They are non-spiritual. They're part of the worldly world. They are profane. They don't really interact with the spiritual world. Culture, meaning all of human accomplishment and activity, is seen not necessarily as evil, but maybe as evil, but at least as a matter of indifference to God. Simply because these other things that I've spoken of are so important, the whole thing of human culture, politics, economics, and so forth, the arts, are a matter of indifference. Acting into culture is necessary, but God has better things to do for Christians that are really sold out to him. Actual enthusiasm or passion for things happening in our culture or in other cultures is seen as kind of disloyal to Christ. Work passionately in the corporate world, in the arts, in the sciences, is seen as very much a second best. The mind, our minds are suspect and easily leading us astray because our minds are not ultimately spiritual because they are shared with those who aren't Christians at all, who don't have the Spirit of God in them. And we have minds just like they have. And if non-Christians have minds, then that's important to them, then it can't be so important to us. I've had people say, come to me in guilt and feeling that it was a spiritual problem to watch a film where there was just a good story but no spiritual message, and feel guilty for enjoying that film because it wasn't a spiritual thing that gave them the enjoyment. It was just a mere human story of love or courage or whatever it might have been. Now, the attraction of all this, of this pattern, is in its simplicity. If you believe it, you can make your life a lot simpler very quickly. In a world of overchoice, of many too many choices to make, and many options of each choice, you know very quickly what's important and what's less important. It helps you streamline your decision-making process enormously. If you want to really honor God, you know right away that certain things are God's top priority on issues of vocation. I feel this is enormously powerful. These ideas are tremendously powerful because you know that top priority for God is to be a missionary or a full-time evangelist or Christian worker. That's the top of the pyramid. If you want to really be sold out to God, that's what you will do and aim at even if you can't do it. And you can imagine how the pyramid comes down, being in different kinds of full-time Christian work, that's okay too, down further to teaching, down further in the corporate world, further probably still into politics, further still probably in the arts or whatever. I don't know how the layers in the pyramid go, but there's very much a pyramid structure of those things that are close to the heart of God, valuable to Him, things that most reflect eternity and eternal values, in things that will never change. This is solidly grounded, it would seem, by the teaching that's really right there in the Bible on the transience of this world. Sure enough, this world is transient. Sure enough, it's changing. Sure enough, things we do here, objects we get a hold of here, don't last. And beside that, the tremendous urgency of evangelism, which is also a very real biblical theme. Those are all the positive sides of what attract people to this. On the negative side, a negative attraction, or an attraction that I view negatively, at least, is that if you believe this, you as a Christian, if you're a Christian, are justified in being proud of ignoring the vast, confusing, threatening river of ideas and activities that make up modern culture. You can be proud of yourself for ignoring them, for knowing nothing about them, being untouched by them. That can be even a measure of your spirituality, that you are completely clueless and separate from these things. It's not ultimately important. They won't last. It's okay to be indifferent to them as much as we're able. Mark Knoll wrote in his book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, I was just talking to somebody about this morning, that for many Christians, they would say that the only thing I need to know about modern, about secular culture, about the world, really, as a whole, is what the Bible teaches about how it's going to end. Okay? Now, that is really true. I've had so many Christians come and give me an earache working for LaBrie, but why do you spend so much time trying to understand modern culture? Why do you try to get Christians to understand modern culture? What's the deal? It's all just going to end. All you really need to know is what the Bible says about how it's going to, how God is going to finish it. Okay, that's the what of this divided life spirituality, and a little bit of why I think it's so powerful. And this gets really powerful, and it gets powerful. It's powerful to us at an emotional level. Even we've had many students with us who, even after getting rid of these ideas, seeing through them, measuring them against the Bible, and deciding they're false, still feel emotionally controlled by those ideas that live on in their imagination. I mean, for example, we even had a guy who grew up in a home in which, or in a church in which, it was immoral to ever go to see a film. He'd gotten rid of it. He no longer believed that. And for at least 3 or 4 years, he was with us. He had still not ever seen a film. But while he was with us, he went with some other students to see a film. And when he went into the theater, had this tremendous emotional reaction. He really felt he was going to get struck by lightning. He really felt that the anger of God was going to somehow come out of the wiring of the church, of the theater, and he had just a tremendous sense of a very visible or very, very tangible, tactile fear. Well, I give this as an example. We're not just dealing with some theological ideas. We're dealing with ideas that really get into our bones and work on us and get us at an emotional level. Now let me just talk of some biblical doubts about all this. This, which is a very highly attractive model in many ways, giving you not only a way to simplify life, but also, and this is one of its downsides as I see, a way to measure other Christians very quickly. You know, you can decide very quickly how mature other Christians by, according to the specific activities that they do, according to their job, according to what they're interested in. You can have sort of a checklist. So you can know where you are and know where other people are relative to God. Okay, doubts, biblical doubts. Doubts from Corinth first. Intriguing, 1 and 2 Corinthians. Because Paul starts right out saying, I can't address you as spiritual men. So here he is, raising the issue of spirituality. I can't address you as spiritual people at all, but as men of the flesh. What is he referring to? Does he mean that they aren't praying enough, they're not worshiping enough, that they don't have fasts and Bible studies enough? Maybe, but maybe not, but that's not what he's actually talking about in 1 Corinthians. What does he refer to? Too much preoccupation with their culture, too much thinking? No, in fact, you read 1 Corinthians, and what he's referring to is a group of people who are very strong in religious experiences, very strong in those relating to God who is eternal in their lives, very strong on the spiritual gifts, on religious activities, extraordinary experiences that they've been having, so much so that they despised Paul himself for having a very kind of a mundane, very ordinary kind of Christian life and experience. No, they were unspiritual, according to Paul, because they were fighting, bickering, and indulging in basically competitive spirituality among themselves. That it was just old-fashioned sin that had gone unaddressed, unrebuked, undisciplined in the body of the church. They're unspiritual because sin was there, live and rampant and unaddressed among them. And Paul calls them unspiritual. I can't even address you as spiritual men. Intriguing how you see this not spun out as we might have hoped. In 2 Corinthians, thinking about the mind, the mind in the Bible is not something that is just a great danger and a menace and or more or less irrelevant because it's shared with the non-Christian world and unspiritual because it's shared with the non-Christian world. The mind, as you know, if you read the New Testament, is meant to be renewed and girded up and put to work and equipped and educated and all these things, meaning it's not that the mind itself is something you can rely on, but the mind transformed by the power of God, by the truth of God, is what we desperately need. I'm fascinated with the passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul is talking about living in a world, but not carrying on a worldly war. 10:3-4 and following, for the weapons of our warfare are not worldly, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. He's speaking of the spiritual battle here. But then he describes what he means by that. He says, we destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ. What he's talking about is the spiritual battle in the heavenlies, the rages between God and Satan. The way it's applied, and what he's talking about here, is that it's fought out, at least in part, that he's talking about in terms of a battle of ideas, of arguments, of ideas that are either plausible to somebody or unplausible to somebody. And we carry it out, or he's carrying it out here, with destroying arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God and making every thought captive to Christ. See, this is amazing for and a total challenge to those who think the mind is sort of intrinsically unspiritual and lowly and far from spirituality. He's talking here about intellectual battles and arguments that are very much central to the spiritual battle that's going on. We need a spiritually alive mind, renewed mind. That spiritual battle is in the world of ideas, and this is an area where we as Christians have failed enormously. You think of the universities in this country, which were started as Christian universities to train people for the ministry, and now it's very, very difficult to get a job in any of them if you let it be known that you're a Christian, let alone have any concern for Christian ministry and for anybody else. It's extraordinary. And as Schaeffer always used to say, that is, before it's an intellectual failure, it's first a spiritual failure. That we lost the battle of the mind in America is first a spiritual failing, a spiritual failing. Now my impression is that Christians don't even think of destroying proud obstacles to the knowledge of God. They make fun of them, joke with other Christians about them, and hope they go away. But they don't go away. They're enormously powerful, and they win over more and more people all the time. They don't just go away. Every thought captive to Christ, not just our thoughts about prayer, Bible reading, worship, and evangelism. All our thoughts about Christ, every thought subject to Christ, captive to Christ. You see, we needed a tremendous enlargement of the category of spirituality. Our thoughts about economics matter. Our thoughts about psychology matter. About politics, they matter too. About the arts, they also matter. Our thoughts about the family matters. And we could go on and talk about every area of life which is important to God. Our studies matter to God if we're students. Our thoughts about evangelism, of course, matter to God as well. Think of issues of of social justice. The world of law, government, and the whole political arena. This isn't spiritual in the narrower sense, but is enormously important to God. And I think of Isaiah chapter 58. In the first 9 verses of Isaiah 58, God condemns those who are very, very busy at exercising private religious activities. Lots of prayer, lots of fasting, lots of devotion to God, lots of spiritual activity. But they have not let the oppressed go free. They have not shared their food with the hungry. They have not clothed the naked. God says God mocks their prayer and fasting. And God says, you've hidden yourself from your own flesh. When you deal with these things, then I'll start listening to your prayers. When you've dealt with and looked at the injustice that you're wreaking on the rest of the population, then I will start taking your prayers seriously, your prayers and fasting. Paul makes it clear in the end of the book of Romans that he wants to preach the gospel where it's never been preached before. But this is his life mission. But he interrupts this plan of taking the gospel to Rome and beyond. He wanted to go to Spain. He interrupts this plan of evangelism to take money back to Christians in Jerusalem. Here, he's concerned for whole people. It was important. They were in trouble. They were actually going hungry, the Christians in Jerusalem. And Paul himself interrupts his evangelistic endeavor to take money all the way back to Jerusalem. Money, filthy lucre, dealing with physical needs. But it was important for him to go. Think of the aspects of ordinary life, the most ordinary aspects of ordinary life that are still vitally important to God and in Christian experience. Romans 14, verse 6 says, he who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. How can you get more secular than eating? You know, just filling your face, okay? There's nothing at all religious about that. But here, Paul is saying, he who eats and eats with thankfulness honors the Lord. Eating with thankfulness is a way of honoring God. God cares about the whole attitude we have to eating. Because if we don't thank God, we're assuming that, hey, he owes us this. This is just natural, normal. Food is just it doesn't come from anywhere, it just falls into my lap. Work, Ephesians 6, verse 7. We are to work as to the Lord, not to men. Any work, not just work for a Christian organization, not just work as an evangelist, but also as a farmer, as a dentist, as a stockbroker, as a teacher. Whatever your work may be, you're to do it as to the Lord. You're to offer up your work to the Lord. You're, of course, meant to be honest and ethical within that work. You're also meant to look for opportunities to share the gospel within that work. But the work itself is to be offered to God. We don't do the work just in order for opportunities for evangelism. We do it because work is good. Work is to be honored. Work is to be lifted up and offered to the Lord himself. Our sexuality, you read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, is very clear that our sexual relationships are a way of honoring God with our bodies. It's very important how we honor God with our bodies sexually. What I'm emphasizing here is the most ordinary, basic, mundane aspects of life. Eating, working, and our sexual relationships. How can you get more basically biological, finally, than that? All of these matter to God. All of these are important to God. We either honor God or we radically dishonor God through all these ways of life. The New Testament teaches, as Martin Luther focused on very hard, the priesthood of all believers. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. All Christians are priests, not just a few people with a special calling. People set apart for a religious life or full-time this or that or whatever. I'm intrigued to remember in the Reformation in Holland, they locked the doors to the churches all week except for Sunday morning. You wonder why. It sounds strange. It wasn't because they were afraid of vandalism. What they were afraid of was people feeling they needed to go into a church to get a religious experience to pray. What they were trying to encourage is that people, you can pray to God anywhere. You can pray to God in the field. You can pray to God in your barn. You can pray to God in your kitchen. God is there. He listens to you. You don't need to go to a religious place to pray to God. You can bypass all this. Jesus has bypassed this because he's the mediator himself. We don't need any other mediation of a building, of stained glass windows, of people making special sounds and noises and dressed in certain suits. We can come to God as he is directly. He also, Luther, has some wonderful things on this theme. He has a wonderful Christmas sermon about shepherds, the shepherds who come and see Jesus, the Christ child just born, and find the Christ child, and then leave after finding the Christ child. And he says, and what do they do? Do they go and immediately build a monastery? He says, no, they go back to their sheep, but they go back as transformed people. They're different people with their sheep, but they go back, basically back to the same way of life that they had had before. He had a real angle on this. He claimed that changing his baby's diapers was more spiritual than anything he'd ever done in a monastery. Now, there's a polemical edge in that, obviously, but you get something of the point that he's trying to say. So what I'm driving at here is it's very difficult to maintain this divided life spirituality as you really get into what the New Testament is about. Very hard to draw lines. Some activities are spiritual, some are just worldly. But rather, as I said at the beginning, all of life is spiritual except for what is actually sin. All sorts of things can be sin. One doesn't want to minimize that as a danger. But the line between sin and righteousness is not between as clear a cut issue between different sorts of activities as is often projected. We're led then to what I described as a creative tension. Jesus never said it was going to be easy to live in the world but not of the world. But he did call us to live in attention, to be in our culture but not possessed by our culture, to be involved in it but yet not owned by it, to be grounded in biblical truths and the whole truth of God, and yet not be tribalized out of the world by holding tight to our truth. The tension comes mainly that we're finite people, that our time is finite, our energy is finite, our resources are finite. We're limited. There's more to be done in every area of life than we have time, energy, and resources to do. So we're to take our work seriously, very seriously, and really work at it and honor God through it. But we're also meant to take prayer and evangelism seriously and worship seriously and really dedicate ourselves to that as well and work at it seriously. What we're not offered is the luxury of saying only one of those matters, do that and you're okay and don't worry about the other. What we're told is rather, yes, both matter deeply to God. I can just be concerned with one and I don't need to be concerned with anything else. But the tension God has put us in is as people who have finite resources, energy, and so on, but there's an enormous amount to do, much more than we'll ever be able to do. And the struggle of life and of vocation is to work out, what does God want me to do? What are things that are really important for me to do, and what can I leave aside? Not what is spiritual and what is not spiritual, but what is God actually directing me to do, and what is he calling me to? Let me quickly make one qualification from the other side. As Schaeffer used to say, the devil never gives you the luxury of fighting a battle on one front at a time, but there's always a battle going on behind you. And that's this, that I'm arguing for involvement in the breadth of life and involving involvement in culture and society. But that's not to say we can't be so involved there that we forget our vertical relationship to God. And I'm certainly not espousing that. I'm saying it's both and, not one or the other. But let me just quickly warn against the other mistake now. As I think of C.S. Lewis's illustration of the drunk trying to get on a horse. His foot keeps falling out of the stirrup. He keeps slipping down. He can't get up on the back of the horse. Finally, he gets up on the back of the horse and falls off the other side. That's so often the track record of ourselves as Christians and also of the church itself. I think of Jeremiah's letter to the exiles in Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 29. They are itching to rebel against Babylon and get home immediately and get back to their land, their city, and so forth. And his letter tells them, no, don't. Don't rebel, don't run away, don't try to come home as quickly as you can. Instead, build houses, plant gardens, eat their produce, seek the welfare of the city and pray on its behalf. And in its welfare, you will find your welfare. This is Babylon. This is the city that's come to symbolize sin itself. They were there. He tells them to stay there. That's what God wants you to be. Daniel is a person who did that. He was in Babylon already. He clearly read this letter of Jeremiah and makes reference to it. He threw himself into serving three different emperors. None of them Christians, all of them tied in terrible, destructive pagan ideas. But he served them faithfully, but always kept his window open to Jerusalem. And we know what trouble that got him into. But you see the balance here. He was involved in serving a totally secular and sinful state, but also his window was open back toward the west, toward Jerusalem, because he knew that's where his ultimate allegiance was. That's where his heart was. He knew that in 70 years his people would go back. When the 70 years were up, it would seem that many Israelites chose to stay in Babylon. Remember, some went back with Ezra and Nehemiah at different stages. But some had a pretty good thing going there. They'd been building houses and eating and planting gardens and eating their produce and making a very good living, and life was very comfortable and much more sophisticated and comfortable than going back to Jerusalem, which was a city that had been transformed into rubble, looks about like Serbian cities do now. And why go back there and get into rebuilding all that when they could stay in Babylon? And this is the other side, that we get in over our heads and we get too much of an allegiance to the world, and we miss out the vital importance of our relationship to God. I think of Woody Allen's brutal characterization of someone who's middle class. Someone who's middle class is someone who takes life very, very seriously, with equal seriousness, God and carpet. And of course, if asked to choose, we will always choose carpet, because what is it? What kind of God is this that shares his throne with carpet anyway? It's certainly not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God, the maker of heaven and earth. I think very sharp point, with equal seriousness, God and carpet. Again, this is a tremendous danger on this side also. Not the primary thing I'm talking about this time, but that must be there. There's no tension, there's no necessary tension between spirituality and involvement in the full breadth of culture, except when that involves specific sin. The tension is in our finite time, energy, resources. Do you see what I'm trying to drive at? The tension is not intrinsic between one set of activities and another, unless those activities are intrinsically sinful. The tension is our finite time and energy and what God actually is calling us to do. If evangelism is the only Christian emphasis, then we get into what one of our Libri members calls one-cylinder evangelism, single-cylinder evangelism, an eight-cylinder engine running on one cylinder. Because you see, evangelism and passionate involvement in society are not mutually exclusive. They are, in fact, profoundly complementary. What are some of the things that make the Christian faith implausible to people today, make evangelism tremendously difficult for people today? It's the terrible track record of Christians in society, not throwing in and trying to build, to cooperate, to build a better world, but withdrawing from it and throwing rocks at it from the outside. Not being taking leadership in all sorts of activities that Christians have taken leadership in before. You think of how the Salvation Army stands out, and how in the present discussion of welfare, how the secular world looks at the Salvation Army and says, my goodness, they're doing a wonderful job. It's not costing the government a cent, and they're doing a better job at it with no extra money or government money than we're doing with our millions. And what's going on? Can we learn anything from them? Tremendous. You talk to anybody in the helping professions, and they have enormous respect for the Salvation Army. Because they're in there. They're not standing up judging, making great pronouncements. They're in there doing it. They're in there serving God, trying to serve people who are really down and out, destitute, not making big noise about it, but accomplishing an enormous amount, and respected as a result of that. You see, one of the main things that makes the Christian faith plausible and persuasive is Christians doing valuable, useful things in society. You can think of what Chuck Colson has done in the prison system, and how that is tremendously respected. I know, because my son is working in the prison system, and says that they can't ignore it. They can't ignore it, because really good things are happening, and it's very powerful. And that gives a whole different kind of authority to speak into that kind of a world. My brother was connected with a church through a missionary organization, a church in El Salvador, where, you remember several years ago, there was a horrendous earthquake there in El Salvador, and enormous numbers of people were lost, and it was back in the hills, and no one could get to it. And there was this church in a nearby town where they just gathered up people in the church, gathered up all the tools and all the supplies and blankets they could, took off, and went to help, and took as much food as they could and so on. It wasn't something in order to do evangelism. It was to help a deep and profound human need. What they found is that an enormous curiosity, why are you here? Why are you doing it? What's going on? What's motivating you? What are you serving? What do you have to gain from this? An amazing opportunity to speak the gospel, which turned out to be a major revival in that church in the months subsequent to the earthquake. So you see, we're not dealing with two mutually exclusive, competitive things. We're dealing with both things that we need to be doing well. Both serve each other. And the task of evangelism is so much easier if we can see out there the work of God in the world through Christian people. 1 Thessalonians 4:11 and 12. Work with your hands as we charge you, so that you may command respect of outsiders. 1 Peter 2:15. For it is God's will that by doing right, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Or Jesus, let your light so shine that people will see your works and give glory to your Father in heaven. All these are having to do with activity in culture, doing it well, doing it responsibly, doing it spiritually, and we will be respected for it, and thus so that our words will be listened to in a very different way. This is the key background to evangelism. So I'm trying to say there's no tension there, but there's a complementarity. This kind of a divided life spirituality, what I would fear is that it is not overthrown and overcome in our country. It'll be, we'll become as Europe has become, with the church reduced to a tiny influence there. The Church of God will never be overthrown, but it certainly can go backwards, and certainly has gone backwards before. Let me read from a fascinating article by a man called J. Gresham Machen, a Presbyterian leader from Princeton Seminary earlier in this century. Amazingly wrote this short essay. Actually, I noticed there's a copy or two of it in the woman who's got the tapes from Ken Myers has a couple of copies of this actual address that Machen gave to students at Princeton Seminary in 1912. It's unbelievably current and very, very powerful. I'd love to be able to read the whole thing to you now, which I don't have the time to do. But it's brilliant into just this kind of a problem we're talking about. I'll read you one paragraph. Our whole system of school and college education is so constituted as to keep religion and culture as far apart as possible and to ignore the question of the relationship between them. On 5 or 6 days in the week, we are engaged in the acquisition of knowledge. From this activity, the study of religion was banished. We studied natural science without considering its bearing or lack of bearing upon natural theology or upon revelation. We studied Greek without opening the New Testament. We studied history with careful avoidance of that greatest of historical movements which was ushered in by the preaching of Jesus. In philosophy, the vital importance of the study of religion could not entirely be concealed, but it was kept as far as possible in the background. On Sundays, on the other hand, we had religious instruction that called for little exercise of the intellect. Careful preparation for Sunday school lessons, as for lessons in mathematics or Latin, was unknown. Religion seemed to be something that had to do only with the emotions and the will, leaving the intellect to secular studies. What wonder that after such training, we came to regard religion and culture as belonging to two entirely separate compartments of the soul, and their union as involving the destruction of both. Now, you see what he's saying here. It is a tremendous indictment about the separation of spirituality from anything to do with the mind, anything to do with education. And if he could say this in 1912, imagine what he would have said if he was wandering around today. He also goes on and speaks of how this is something we have done to ourselves. This is something we can't blame sort of nasty secular humanists for. We have shot ourselves in the foot, both feet, and have done this unto ourselves. There's nobody else that we can blame. These powerful ideas have won people's minds over. They need to be won back. The problem we face, and that he called attention to in this essay, is not so much strong opposition to the Christian faith, but an intellectual atmosphere within which Christianity can't even be heard, even when it is spoken. And in 1912, he's talking about. And if that was true then, how much more true it is now. And not an atmosphere that is hostile in the sense that people take us seriously enough to argue with us, but an atmosphere in which even when it is spoken, it is not heard. It just goes right past. So unthinkable, so strange, that people don't even engage in it. He was saying this in 1912. Most people reject the gospel without even knowing what it is. And again, Machen pointing out that modern culture is not so much against the Christian faith, it's out of connection with it. He uses a fascinating image, saying that modern culture is like a massive river. Think of the Mississippi River going down with tremendous force downstream. The church is standing on the bank of the river, wondering, what can we do? What can we do? On the bank watching. We can't stop the flow. We can't stand against it. We don't understand it. Unless we get into it, unless we enter into it and get involved in it, his point is that the church is going to be relegated to doing all its work in the eddies and backwaters of the river as it goes downstream. You see, in every river there will be places where water molecules are going upstream, in eddies and backwaters, where you see water will be turbulent around a rock or around a promontory of land, and you're actually have water go upstream. He says, We're going to have to do as the church is, find places in modern culture which are eddies and backwaters where we can locate people who will listen to us. Unless we get into the stream and get to understand it and work to actually stand against it. What an amazing image, a pathetic image of the church having to work in eddies and backwaters of a massive river sweeping down to the sea. He says, some modern thought must be refuted, the rest must be subservient. Nothing can be ignored. Again, we need to tackle this culture and deal with it head on. So, here in concluding, do you see why involvement in culture and involvement in spiritual things, narrowly defined, is not in tension, but rather complementary to each other? If understanding the modern world and modern culture doesn't drive you to prayer, nothing will drive you to prayer. The more you understand it, the more you'll understand the need for prayer. The more you try to understand it and don't understand it, the more you'll see your need for prayer in order that you would understand it. And these mustn't be mutually exclusive. No conflict between prayer and involvement in our culture. Some Christian organizations have done studies of, particularly organizations working in university settings, and discovered that people are the best evangelists within the first year of their own conversion. That's amazing. Most effective evangelists within the first year of their own conversion. This amazed them. And they wondered why, and they investigated. It's because then they still have friends who are not Christians. So the Christian organizations haven't got their meat hooks on them yet and tribalized them and got them in within the quarantined ghetto, but they're still out there with actual friends who are not Christians. Amazing. But it means that we, in our Christian organizations or in our churches, sometimes do damage to the very cause we're trying to further. So, just in concluding here, really makes a big difference to me, really a change in my life now. I know that I can pray as I wash dishes and that will make it spiritual. Now, needless to say, that is just what I don't mean. Or someone will say, it's okay and it's spiritual to work as an accountant because if I work as an accountant for 40 years, I may be able to lead someone to Christ who works beside me in the accountant's office. That's wonderful if you can do that, but that's not the reason being an accountant is worthwhile. Being an accountant is worthwhile because it's honoring God by your work, by the work of your hands, by the work of your mind, offering it to God Himself. And of course, we do it morally. We do it also looking for opportunities to share the gospel, but we mustn't draw a line there between some activities matter to God, other activities don't matter to God. So all of life is spiritual except what is sin. All of life is spiritual except what is sin. C.S. Lewis put this, the same thing, somewhat differently. He said, it's not that some things are religious and others are non-religious. He said some things are religious and others are irreligious. Saying exactly the same thing that Schaeffer did. Religious and irreligious. Hans Ruckmacher, who was involved in the beginning of Le Brie, died in the mid-70s and was a great loss to us. He's a professor of art history in Holland. But he was profoundly involved in helping Christians get involved in our society, particularly to do with the arts. But he said a thing that I've always found helpful. He says, most people look at our society and see what must be done, or get a hint of what must be done, are overwhelmed and do nothing. And that's so easy. I think the more we understand, you may respond that way after being at a Le Brie conference for a weekend, because there's just so much to know, so much to understand, it's easy to be overwhelmed and do nothing. But he recommended three things. We must weep, we must pray, and we must work. And I think those are wonderful things to remember, and I'll end there. We must weep, we must pray, and we must work. And now we've got a good time, I hope. How much time do we have? Do you know when we're meant to end this? Is supper at 5:30? Or is that it? So we have 40 minutes or so, 50 minutes for trading it around with each other. So over to you all. Jim.
Yes. One thing I would like to ask you comment on is, I think that our work or these issues that we're struggling with aren't lived out exactly. I think we one thing we're called to is obedience, but another thing is community, fellowship. There's some aspect of that that I'm just interested in your thoughts on. On how if I consider one job over another, we live in a world that is so mobile, it's just easy to uproot yourself and go plop yourself down in a situation that professionally might make sense, but in terms of the fellowship, we've just cut ourselves off from the people that can help us most in living out our faith in any kind of meaningful way. Because we value that better position, or being effective in the world, we do it on our own terms, and we do it to a lone ranger, and I think we lose a lot of what we can have.
Mm-hmm.
We abandon the fellowship just to pursue some goal. I'm being very vague.
No, I think that's particularly a problem at every level. Did everybody hear that? He spoke of the need for community and how that's a part of our whole life before God, and we can very easily get on a very individualistic track following just the next best job on the way up, which forces us to be very mobile and breaks the relationships with any community that we might form. I think that's one of the places we must challenge modernity. We can't undo the Industrial Revolution. We've got to work in it. We've got to try and deflect it insofar as we can in our own experience. That's one area which I think we need to tackle, which I would want to see the church teaching, that you can't say that you must remain in the town of your birth, because that's just unrealistic in the world today. But you can say mobility is to really be resisted, because if we take seriously our responsibility to serve Christ, it involves service to Christ corporately with others in the body of Christ. How can you possibly serve the body of Christ if you're moving every 3 years? You never get to know people in a church in that setting. The trouble is the most gifted people, who are most jerked around by the economy, move the fastest and have the least impact on their churches. That's the sad truth of it all. And I think it makes a great deal of difference, too, to our ability to experience work as meaningful, because we work not just as a lone ranger camping out in this city for a while and going to another, but we work in an area, in a place. We have a church in that place. That's part of the whole life of community that's there. It's community is a battle in the world today because of so many forces working on it to fragment it. But I think it's important at a number of levels in the things you're talking about. Did you want to pick up on this too?
I'm just going to suggest, I had a friend who was assistant pastor at a church in a predominantly military town. And then what triggered my thinking about that was moving every 3 years, or even more often.
Sure.
But he pointed out that the people, the military people, the people that were those families, and his church in particular, which was predominantly comprised of military families, they built relationships very quickly because they knew that if they didn't, they'd never have any anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they would build their relationships very quickly, and they would assimilate to one another in church and become a functional Christian community, or become part of a functional Christian community very quickly. Now, that's just an intensified environment for that military normal, where you 1 or 2 years or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, as you were talking about that, I'm thinking that, as believers and collectively as believers in the congregations we're in, we have to be able to deal with that, because the mobility, even though it's to be resisted in reality,
mm-hmm.
then it has to be dealt with somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what hurts.
Yeah, that's an unusual church. Because by far and away the greater tendency is, because I'm in and out pretty soon anyway, I won't risk relationship at all. Why bother? Because I won't be able to build much of a relationship, and I'm just going to be off. So he must have taught about that in a very purposeful way.
That it was the Christian, it was the believers, and the folks who were in his church and some other churches, pastors in town that he knew. Those people were quick to build those relationships. There were plenty of people who were unbelievers or who were just ambivalent who did exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke about that, the opposite syndrome, where there was just this, I'm breezing through town, I don't really get to know anybody too very well, I'm just going to
mm-hmm.
blow in and blow out in a couple of
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And it's a real danger. Yep. We have to fight that in the church.
That's right. I would like to see a more purposeful resisting that. Obviously, it's hard to do that. The military is, you know, is the military, and it's hard to do much to that. But the vast majority of people, like around where I live, very high-tech area, oh, we've got to leave. It's ridiculous. We've got to leave. What do you mean you've got to leave? And, of course, it isn't. You've got to leave, but the next best job up the ladder requires leaving. And there's so little courage to resist the demand of the economic system to jerk people around. It's just no choice. There's no awareness of choice of many people today. It's just, well, that's where the next job is, and off we go. And I that's an area that I think we really need to resist. Yeah, Jim.
On the other side of that, though, I think my observation of having moved around, I was, you know, Navy junior for 3 years, we would move, and I have the sense that a lot of what you experience in going from place to place is that going to different churches is like going to a fast food place. I mean, it's like you can go to McDonald's or you can go to Burger King, and they're very much the same from place to place, and there's not much local character. You know, they're different faces, but it's just a different brand.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this sense of, about the depth or the meaningfulness of having a meal in a fast food place as opposed to anything of real substance.
Yeah, and that may be just I see that as a real problem, because how can you, if that's the way you experience the church, you're not getting to know the people in the church. They're not getting to know you. They're not getting your gifts are not being used in that church. How would they know what gifts you've got? They don't know you very well. How do you know what gifts you have that you can use? Because you don't know the church that well. So I've heard studies done by just on mobility where people saying, how long does it take you when you move to a new place to be really at home there so you can be giving out rather than just coping with having moved and trying to figure out how things work and where to go to get this and where to go to get that and who says that and who when are we going to break the law if we do this and all this stuff. And the studies are basically 2 years. That's a long time, but I can absolutely believe it. 2 years until you're really home there and able to give out rather than just being trying to figure out how to paddle your own canoe and survive. Now, obviously, that would be, you have to hit the ground running to some degree, but for someone who really can be fruitful in the way that being fruitful in a church requires, that's a big chunk of, you know, to spend time adjusting when you move every three. So that's a hard one. Now, again, not to spend the whole time on this, but this is an important issue. Any other things we'd want to raise, or should we carry on in this direction?
The last year is preparation to leave.
Yeah, there you go. Looking for the new job, getting new interviews.
It's a 3-year thing.
Yeah.
And I think too that not every member of the family responds in the same way.
Oh.
Some members of the family can react quickly, and maybe just find those few people, but especially in a church situation, to develop a trust with the individual for that church to be able to trust you.
Yep.
To give you positions of responsibility or leadership. A church needs to be careful. Church does not wisely take on someone who just walks in the door and declares themselves to have been part of the denomination for a while. I mean, and so those things take time, and then the personal relationships. And the last year, you're wondering, well, should I say yes? I mean, I hate to say yes and then just walk out of these folks in another few months. And it's pretty practical.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. But it's very hard to resist it because that's the system we're in, and it means it really is resisting it to do anything different. Yes?
Can you speak to some of what you're talking about, people like myself that would love to retreat to that kind of world and not have to think about all these things in my mind, just being stretched up? I feel like it's going to pop here this weekend.
There's more to come.
In this age of the efficiency, and especially for women, let me be everything to everybody, and wanting to embrace this thought of being in the culture and an active Christian participant, and yet not
Oh, yes, very, very much. I'm not sure quite where to go with it. A sense of vocation, I think, is a great help, because that brings limitation on your service to God. Not limitation in your zeal, but limitation in the scope of what God expects you to do and spend your time on. So I think a big thing in terms of just getting involved in the world, the world is a big place, and is impossible. But what part of that world are you working in? Are you part of? Are you struggling with already? How can you widen the boundaries of what you're already doing? I would start from where you are. I have no idea what you're doing, of course. Well, we hope it is, but not to paralysis, you know? I mean, the idea is that, you see, my image is, and I think this is true for all of us in the Brie, is not that everybody needs to become a heavy academic. You know, we're dealing on the fringes of the academic world ourselves, trying to keep up to speed in some very poor way in some areas. But what I'm concerned for is that, why can't Christians be curious people? Why can't Christians be curious people about this amazing world we're living in, this extraordinary society that we're a part of? With the wonder of it is what it to be a human being and to be alive today in our moment of history. Why can't we be people who are really interested rather than just sitting on our duff and watching the television and just phasing out? You know, my concern is that to get Christians revved up and riled up to be engaged, to use their time, to use their energy, to use their gifts, to understand what bit they can and they're interested in. I would start from where you're interested. What's most interesting to you? We, in coming here, are trying to just throw out as big a breadth as we can. It seems to me this is... either just intimidating and paralyzing, which we really don't want to be doing, we're trying to make it accessible and also encouraging, or it can be stimulating and encouraging to do our own work, our own thing, our own thinking, our own struggling. That's what we're aiming at, and we certainly don't want to be a discouragement, but rather a catalyst. But that's all we can be, I guess. Except, we have all the branches too, which that's what we're trying to do. And people come, I hope that's the effect of being at Libri. Any of the branches of Libri is also becoming a more curious person, a more concerned with the breadth and wonder of God's world and how we can serve Him in it. I stumbled into the Swiss Libri the year after I finished college, having given up on learning. I knew some people who were smart enough to hold it all together. I knew I wasn't smart enough to hold it all together. I was smart enough to cram before exams and pass exams and then forget it all. And then cram before the next exam and pass that and forget that too. And I thought, this is not where it's at. And I just, when I graduated, I boxed all my books up and sold them all. Sold all my books. Because I said, learning is just an absolute waste of time. I wasn't a Christian at all. I'm going to have fun. And I'm going to enjoy myself. I'll do skiing and rock climbing, and I'll have a blast. I don't want to tell this long story, but I stumbled into Libri in Switzerland. And being there 1 week, some light got turned on of excitement with learning, that learning could be not just fruitful but exciting to do. And it was mainly Schaefer putting together all... I'd studied history as much as anything, putting together all sorts of things that I'd not been able to put together, whole patterns of history in the last couple of hundred years, suddenly was making sense, which hadn't at all before. And so I thought, oh my goodness, look at this. And then I thought, well, look at what I've done to a 4-year college education at a good college. I've booted it. I've just booted it, which I did. And I had a lovely time. He had a great time doing sports, but booted it. But I've never recovered from that time of an excitement and a curiosity of learning and going. And that's, we try to give the same encouragement because the world is an amazing place, and God wants us to be out there in it and serving Him in it and not intimidated by it. I'm just sort of wafting on, not really getting at your question, I guess. But I would start where you're at. And no, it's not just academia itself that's the solution. Yes. No, the academic world in many ways is deeply jaded.
It's a flawed model for learning.
Yeah.
It really is.
I mean, oh, yes. No,
it robs a lot of excitement. I don't know how many young people I see go into academia excited and come out just worn out.
Yeah, that's right, and cynical about the politics of it all. And absolutely. No, academia isn't the solution. That's why I'm not pushing for Christians to become all academics. But if we can get something from the academic world, let's grab it, use it, take it, run with it. Maybe God is calling us to go into the academic world. That's a tremendous calling. It's a wonderful calling. But it's not as if that's the answer for Christians. It is a wonderful calling, and we've encouraged people often to go into academia, but it's certainly not the answer. The answer is wherever God is calling us, which is a very, very diverse area. Yeah, the modern university is sick for all sorts of reasons.
And we're doing all this collectively. We're not individually responsible for every element that we absorb or understand has to be addressed. Led by the Spirit, there are things that we can do individually.
Yeah, and there are resources for anyone who can speak English, read English today, which are extraordinary, which haven't been around for a long, long time to Christian people. I mean, I just think of the existence of this periodical, I think it's a bi-monthly thing called Books and Culture, put out by Christianity Today. There's been nothing like that. At that level, that comes out of the Christians in the academic world, admittedly, but it's speaking about all sorts of interesting issues at a very good level, very accessibly written, and very substantial. That is so encouraging to me. When I first became a Christian, there was nothing remotely like that on the horizon. Very good thing to get for any of us interested in this. And there's an enormous amount of resources that we can turn to now that weren't there before, because the thing that's encouraged me in terms of this horrible polarity of saltless salt and light under a bushel of wimps and thugs is that there's a lot of people I meet who are fed up with that and are wanting something better. Are really committed to doing something different, and that's exciting. That's wonderful. Yes. I'm sorry.
I find hard to leave this environment and go back to church. I can't find a church.
Yeah.
Way.
Yeah, and LaBrie can make it worse. yeah, I do attend a local church, which. it's a long story. It's a basically black church. We're probably the only white family in it, not the only white people, but the only white family. And it's absolutely wonderful. And we've been going there about 3 years now. It's revolutionized our approach to worship and all sorts of good things. It's not as if the particular we're introducing a lot of LaBrie ideas to them and them to us, and it's a process. So it's not as if we find. Well, we are finding with individuals a real interest in what we're doing. We bring so many people to church; it's amazing, and they really notice. And wonder, what are you doing with all these people? So there's been a real interest there, but it's a gradual thing of sort of introducing them to what LaBrie is all about and doing. But the black church in many ways isn't stuck in the same dualistic framework that a lot of the white church is. For example, in political areas, they've got no question of seeing politics as something not spiritual or something, but it's part of the whole picture. And it has been for a long time. So they're not dealing with that sort of dualism, but very involved in society. You don't have to encourage them to get involved in the secular culture. There's They're involved in everything, all over the place. So it's all sorts of battles that we've been fighting in white churches aren't necessary to fight there. They've got other issues, but it's been a great time for us. But I think to find some people of like mind, even in your church, you don't need to find a church that's passionately going in this direction, but to find some people who you can start with and who will be willing to discuss things with. And chances are you can find somebody, you know, but you need help, you need collegiality, you need camaraderie, you need mutual support, because you think you're going crazy if you try it alone. That's really important, I think. Now, it's obviously better if we can get, say, groups within a church or even a whole church to be concerned in that direction. But I think we've got to be in it for the long haul, though. It's not going to be any quick solution. Yeah, Mike.
Could this excitement or this adventure that we're supposed to be living in this world have anything to do with David in Psalm 8, where he begins with the majesty of God in the psalm, mm-hmm. ends with the majesty of God, and in the middle of the psalm, he said, "What is man that you're mindful of him?" Or today we could say, "What does it mean to be a man or a woman in the 20th century in the culture that I live in today, and how do I interact with that culture and the adventure of it, mm-hmm. the excitement of it?"
That's right, and it must start with the big picture. It's got to start with the cosmic scale, and that's what we take to the specifics of our daily lives, is knowing a God who is this God, who spoke and the whole shmear came into existence, which is something else again. That's right, that's helpful. Yes, Laura, did you have something? Do you have a hand, or?
I did. I've been struggling for years now, off and on, with difference or no difference between what you just spoke of as being called to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that if all of our work matters, it's all meaningful and God cares about all of it, does it really matter? Whether I work for this company doing this particular thing, that company doing that particular thing, how to know exactly where it is God wants me to be, or is it that wherever I am, as long as it's not sin and I'm fulfilling a purpose. But I just have to address those issues. That's been a struggle for me all along. I feel like sometimes it matters totally to God where I am, and then it really doesn't matter at all, because that isn't the focus.
Yeah. That's really tough. It's really hard. Well, no, I certainly can't answer today. You're dealing there with guidance. And God guides us so differently, different people, different ways, and different ones of us, different ways at different times in our lives. And at times it certainly seems that it matters a great deal to God that we're in this place or in this relationship or in this whatever at this time. At others, not at all. But I'm not at all sure that that's true. Do you see what I'm saying? Because we're looking at the backside of the tapestry. And just given the way God guides us, sometimes with very strong inclinations and in intuitions that this is the right thing that we can't get past and we go for it, sometimes with even almost, well, very real supernatural guide, depending on who we are and what's going on in our lives. I've known people who get very direct supernatural, who have had very direct supernatural guidance, even to the point of God speaking to them, which I usually don't believe when someone tells me that, but some people I do believe it. And just because I see the word God told me, or the phrase God told me, so totally abused and overused. Other times, at the other extreme, people who are sometimes guided in very intimate and supernatural ways get to a place and they have a choice of three things in front of them, and they can sense nothing, no biblical truth they can bring to it, no sense of intuition, it would seem supernatural guidance, and there they are, and the decision's got to be made tomorrow. So waiting is no good. It's got to happen tomorrow. Or the decision is made tomorrow by your decision or non-decision. And sometimes I think God uses that to make us grow, to lead us to grow, to simply trust his providence, that I'm, Lord, I don't know, but I'm just going to have to step in one direction, and here I go. Stop me if it's wrong, but I see nothing the matter with this. This looks like, and we have to go. And those times we think, well, it would be the same to God, whatever I took. Maybe, but maybe God is guiding me through that very choice. But I guess I want to resist very much the idea that God's path for me through life is on a delicate catwalk over an abyss, you know? And should I make a wrong step, I'll never get back on his track again. But it's a very delicate way and brittle way of looking at God's guidance, so that you once step off the path, and who knows? Because you made a mistake back there, everything's been out of whack for the last 13 years. That's totally wrong. It's part of the whole mystery of the way God works in this world. God deals with us with where we are. Sure, our mistakes matter. Our mistakes are costly. Sure, our mistakes, we may not know how costly they are. But so also the good things we do, we don't know how beneficial they are. But I think God guides us with an enormous diversity of things. In terms of vocation and things like that, the big, big decisions we make of whole directions to go in, a strong thing, I think, for people is what are their burdens, what do they think they're good at, gifted at. I think we often enjoy doing things that we're good at and also are gifted at things, well, obviously gifted at things that we're good at, but also enjoy doing them, feel... And also are apt to feel burdens for, it's good that this would be done. I feel that this is important to do. And so God leads us, I think, very often through things like this, through inclinations and priorities, that this is what ought to be done. There really needs to be a work in the arts here. Or there needs to be someone doing that there. And within that, I think there may be all sorts of different tracks we can take. But God is with us personally, all the time, whether he guides us through the Bible, whether he guides us through circumstances themselves, sometimes force us to do things or into choices that we wouldn't necessarily have chosen. But God is with us all the time, and I think makes himself clear to us as clear as he wants to be. And so that's I haven't really answered it, but just that it's so diverse, and there's no one way of getting guidance from God, I think. Yes.
There's a book that I found helpful that had any influence on this divided life kind of system. One called Decision Making in the Will of God, NASA put it out. And it,
Oh, yes. That's and a Van of Friesen? Yeah.
I found that very helpful for that type of background in thinking.
Yeah. I have qualifications about it, though, in that. He tends to say, I may not be fair to him, but he tends to say, I think, that people have such trouble with the individual will of God for them because there is no such thing. The book is our only source of guidance. We've got the Bible. That is our guidance. That is the will of God for us. And he's right that that is the primary source of guidance for us. And he's right to resist the very subjective approaches to guidance where people want special guidance for whether to brush their teeth or not, or to turn right or left at the street corner or not, and expect a supernatural interaction, which really is much more like divination than it is the faith you see in the Bible. They don't like to, I'll be talking about this, I think, tomorrow night or something, sometime. A lot of the very subjective forms of guidance are really much closer to forms of paganism than they are the kind of spiritual. Yeah. But I do believe that God is interacting with each of us personally. And I think that is mainly through the Scriptures and through putting our lives on the line before the Scriptures. But I think it's also through circumstance and through opening and closing doors and things like this, as we have the Scriptures first and foremost for us. Like I think the Schaeffers, let's say, to get specific about it, if you remember, those of you heard the Labrie story. Well, those of you who haven't, Dr. and Mrs. Schaeffer were stuck in Switzerland with the government, Swiss government, going to throw them out of the country. I can't say why. All it gets is much too long a story. If they don't own a property by basically the next day.
have to own a property by the next day, otherwise they have to leave the country, having started this work in Switzerland. And she prayed, "Lord, we need $1,000 by tomorrow. And I'll take that to be your guidance that we're meant to go forward with this rather than to boot the whole thing, to scrap the whole thing and give up on it and go back to America." $1,000 came in the mail the next day, and that's why LaBrie exists, because that happened and they responded to it. Now, I think they would have been disobedient if they had got the $1,000 and then say, "We think this is a bad idea, we're going to go home anyway." You see what I'm saying? It's not violating a biblical principle, but I think it violates the whole way they were pursuing the guidance of God, the whole way God had been leading them. And I think they should have gone forward, given that circumstance and that prayer. That, I think, was an open door. Now, Vreeson is very good in that book showing the very flippant and cheesy ways we throw all sorts of terms around about being guided by God in a very subjective way, which really are not the real thing and are just us being kind of flippant about the guidance of God. But I do believe that God deals with us as individuals as well in a more intimate way than just giving us the principles from a book, even though the principles from the book are the main backdrop and source of our guidance. So that's a long one.
Yeah, I don't have that impression from that he was in conflict with that idea.
Yeah, well, the drift of the book is in that direction, is don't worry about a personal will of God for you. The will of God for you is in the Bible already, and that's all you need. And
one of the examples would be like in courtship. You know, you're dating a couple different guys or something, and then so which one? Well, God doesn't have a chapter and verse on you marry so and so and don't marry this guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but you have. Well, why? You know, you can make the decision for your life based on principles from God's word. Why so and so might be a better husband for you than this other guy you're dating.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, it's personal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I kind of took it. He's really giving you a personal, the way you can look at the scriptures in a personal way, without having a specific, you know, sign or extra biblical kind of.
But I think extra-biblical things do function in ways that are important to us as well. Though the biblical norms are the main thing. Yes?
Nick, I don't know all the details. I understand the paper that's done on the shooting. A dozen or so people were killed in Atlanta yesterday. If my wife were one of those, from your lecture on Providence, from the Will of God discussion, and I said, "Nick, why? What could you tell me?"
I would first have to say, I don't know why. And I'm not going to be able to tell you why. And I would also believe that what you need most is not actually an answer to the question why. And even if you could get a hold of... I say this with some experience, having... I'm thinking of one instance, talked to a woman who just lost her husband, asking why and how can God be good and all these things, and having been stupid enough to try and tell her and go into my version of the resolution of the problem of evil when her husband has just died, that wasn't what she needed, and I will never try it again. I have respect for Job's friends, particularly for the first 7 days when they surrounded him and were speechless. I have a hunch they might have been helpful to him during that time, just because they were there. They were probably weeping. They were there because they cared for him. They didn't have a clue what to say. That might have been helpful to Job, because he didn't know what to say either. They jumped in, or no, he jumped in. He asked for it. But then that's what they said, okay, now we have something we can do. And so they got in with their own philosophy and theology and made a total mess of it and put him farther from God than he'd been in the beginning. So I'm in a sense just going away from your question, because what we're dealing with is the sort of reality of grieving and the shock and this kind of thing, which isn't really the issue. The issue is a bigger philosophical, moral issue, whatever our psychological state is. But I just wanted to throw in the psychological reality of trying to fix somebody in the midst of and make them feel okay when they've just experienced an absolutely life-shattering loss. We're very stupid to try to be the sucker to answer why and think we can come up with a satisfying answer why. But even in the cool of the day, 6 months later, someone asks why, and I don't have an answer then either. I can do more to ask why I still believe God is good. And there I'll talk about that more tomorrow night. It centers more on the cross than it does my calculus of the amount of good and evil in the world, or when evil happens and what happens as a result of it, or whatever. I think we don't have answers to that. I think the people who are most helpful to people in those situations are people who can cry with them and let them tell their story and how it looks to them and how it feels to them, and let them get it out, maybe even for a long time afterward. That not only is there not a specific answer to the specific question they're raising, but that's not really what's going on in them either. Is the demand to that question. But I have to say, what do I know about why? That is a loose thread in the back of the tapestry that doesn't look like it's attached to what it ought to be attached to. And I'm not about to jump in and say, this is where it goes, when I can't see where it goes. God will let us know eventually as much as we need to know. But I think even over time, God doesn't necessarily tell us why. And I'll be arguing that in the next lecture, that we are not necessarily very equipped to read God's providence and say what God's motivations were in doing various things. Sometimes maybe we can, but particularly when evil, with evil and life-destroying situations like that, I think we're very ill-equipped. Particularly, you see, if there's an asymmetrical relationship between God's relationship to good and evil is asymmetrical, it's much more direct with good than evil, then it would make sense that it's going to be harder for us to figure his motivation when it comes to evil in the world. I'll try and get into that a little more, but it's even over time, I'm not sure we're going to be able to say. I can think of someone in our church in London, a guy who died at age 29 of cancer, having been married a year and a half. Guess you're asking questions, why? And through his death and the prayer and the different, all the commitment of prayer for him in the church, another guy became a Christian. And somebody else in the church said, that's why he died. What do we make of that? His widow didn't like it much. What sort of a God is it that has to pull that sort of trade-off? It's a great temptation to do that, but I think it's that. I think it's a temptation, and I don't think it's honoring God to say that, because we don't know. What do we know about why God has done something like that, to allow someone to die at age 29 of cancer? I think we know very little, and let's admit it. Much safer. So that's a sort of a rambling non-answer. But we like to be able to have an answer. We like to be able to fix situations. But I think it's much better and more truthful to admit we don't have an answer.
It's the hope that's authentic, not the ability to explain.
That's right. And it's the witness to who God is. Not why God has done what he's done or not done what he hasn't done or whatever. It's to who God is and the hope we have in Christ. That's where it's at.
Your point that, well, I don't know that, but I do know this.
Yeah.
I do know that there is a good God, and I know that here's what that good God has provided, has done, and that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
And that does reside at the cross.
That's right. That's where it comes to a stop.
As though God then has subsequently proved that he is good. You know?
Mm-hmm.
He has already proved he is
good. That's right. That's right. Any other things we'd want to... I've had some... Yes?
I just want to find out what I would like to hear
Decision-Making and the Will of God by Gary Friesen. How's it spelled? Anyone spell it? It is by Multnomah Press as well, so you shouldn't have too much trouble finding it. Yeah, any other things you'd like to raise? Yes?
I'm going to just make a couple comments. First of all, the demand of lying from the it to me is presumptuous. You can ask for a lie, but I think we have to be careful to not demand from God anything. And we want it, yes, and you can tell God that we want it with heartfelt desire. But that doesn't mean that he has the obligation to give it to us. Because he's not obligated. He has obligated himself to give us salvation when we ask. He's obligated himself to give us grace when we ask. And he's obligated himself to give us many things, but not the answers to what.
Yeah, that's true.